wait to get it all started and then can't hear anyone talking.
I'm kind of soft-spoken, so.
Oh, no. I can hear you loud and clear.
Good.
Bill?
Well, maybe that's something that, that you don't want to say. Maybe you can say, you know, well, we don't hear you so well, so don't worry about what you say. Don't want to make anybody nervous.
Nah, it's not a big deal. Okay, well, let me just tell you a little bit about what we're going to do, just to let you know what the kind of routine is. Basically, we're just going to get your story and whatever parts you feel comfortable telling, whatever you remember, whatever you want to share with us, and that's fine. And we'll just spend as much time as you want to, and we'll just talk. It's not anything formal. It's not going to be a big journalism thing, so that's it.
And I think, too, we might want to try to speak a little bit about Marcus and his life and try to essentially give us the information to really tell the story. And if you're comfortable with that.
Oh, I am.
Okay.
Well, I need to start by doing an introduction so we know who all is here. So, first off, I'm Sarah Milligan. I'm with the Kentucky Oral History Commission. Today is April 23rd. Is that right?
Yes.
That is correct.
Thanks. 2009. I'm here with Bill Bright. We're interviewing Martha Davis about her military history and her family military history. And so we'll just start there. First, just give us a little bit of background about yourself. Where are you from? Where's your family from?
Okay. I was born and brought up in Harlan County, Kentucky, Everts to be precise. Mm-hmm. And my mother was a housewife. My dad was a coal miner. And they had seven children. The first two didn't survive to adulthood. So I was the first, you know, like the firstborn, because the oldest always gets these special chores and everything. But out of seven children, she only had two boys. The oldest was a boy, and he died in a childhood accident. The next one was a girl, and she died from pneumonia as an infant. It was just before antibiotics came into being. And I came along number three, and I was a keeper. So.
What year was that?
I was born in 1941.
1941.
My brother Mark, the only other boy that they had, was born. I've tried to figure out. I have trouble keeping track of who all. I believe it's 46, June of 46.
Mm-hmm.
So we always kind of had a sibling rivalry because as a girl, I was held back a lot. I was angry with my parents for a long time because they trusted me, but they didn't trust other people. So I didn't get out a whole lot growing up, but he got to do a whole lot more as a boy. But after we grew up, we were really good friends, and I was happy about that for the way things worked out. So,
mm-hmm.
My dad was a union coal miner, and just at the right time, the UMWA built these hospitals and had nursing schools, and I was able to make the grade to go to the first. I was in the third graduating class,
mm-hmm.
for the Miners Memorial Hospital, which was in Harlan, where the RN school was. So I went to school to be a nurse about 12 miles from where I was, you know, Everett, where I was born.
Mm-hmm.
As part of, my family was not into education per se, like everybody went to college, because in nursing school, we went, the first two semesters, we went to Morehead University or State College, whatever it was in those days, as part of the curriculum.
Mm-hmm.
So my little brother and my last little sister came along. They both ended up going to Morehead on loans and everything. So my brother was a very bright kid, and he was a born leader. He was into history. That's what he majored in. And if he'd survived Vietnam, he was killed in Vietnam at 1970. He was 23 years old. He was drafted just after graduating college. He went to Florida and worked as a teacher for 3 months before the draft got him.
Mm-hmm.
And we learned just the last 6 months, you know, 40 years later, the person in charge of the school board was also in charge of the draft. And someone told us that knows that if he'd come home to Harlan County and taught school, he would not have been drafted per se. That when he went to Florida to teach, his name went right to the top. So I like to think, you don't have to put this online, but I like to think that person is roasting somewhere.
Why?
He played God.
Why is the difference between him going to Florida and him going back down to Harlan County?
Well, he was a very bright kid.
Yeah.
And he was, he'd made a great math teacher because during the time he was growing up, he played football, he played all the sports, but he wasn't that tall or that athletic. But when you don't have that many kids, you know, the coaches used him as a tutor to get bigger, stronger kids, the grades to play football.
Right.
And my mom tells how at various times he helped teachers grasp the math concept so they could teach it to other kids. And he was just a really bright kid. And she was always working hard to make sure he tried to slough off because it wasn't cool to make good grades. But she'd, you know, be right there and be on him. So he went to Vietnam, and he was called up, I guess, 68. And it took a year or so to get trained because he went to airborne school. And she says that he told her he was signed up to come back to UK in August. He would get his master's in history, but he was killed in April. So I always like to say that if my life would have been a lot different if either of my brothers had lived, you know, because you wouldn't have to be the man in the family and all that. But so then my younger sister Mary, she got her master's and she's been a teacher all these years. She retired last year. So I don't know. I was telling him that as part of the nursing school, you had to work, you had a contract to work in the area, in the mountains, for a year after school. So to cut the apron strings, I went all the way across the mountain to Perry County, worked in the hospital there for a year. And then, I don't know where the idea came from, but there was a Navy nurse recruiter out of Louisville, and she came to visit us once a month. So then, that year after, I've been there a year, the union said we can't keep these hospitals, so that's when they sold them, I think, to the Presbyterians for a year or two before they became the Appalachian Regional. But I said, I want to go in the Navy. I'd always kind of had an itchy foot and wanted to see more because I hadn't really been anywhere or done anything. So my dad was always kind of disciplinarian, but he did it through my mother. He never did it himself, you know. He always worked the evening shift or something. So I went home, and I was 21 or 22, and I said, I'd like to join the Navy. And he said, no, 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 no. It hurt my feelings and made me cry. So then he said, well okay. You know, he couldn't stand to see you cry. So that's how I was allowed to join the Navy.
So what did your parents...
It's kind of silly.
when you told them, rephrase that for us. Like, explain to us how you actually went home and what they're...
I went home on a weekend, I guess, so I didn't even have a car in those days. If I went home from Hazard to Harlan County, my dad would come get me or something, but I just said, Daddy, I think I want to join the Navy. You know, I like to do something. He was just flabbergasted because in those days, culturally, in the mountains, the military you would look down upon, especially in peacetime. And then in wartime, you know, everybody's a little bit more popular. But I don't know if we even knew. No, I had one aunt who was in the WACS briefly during World War II, but not very long. But that didn't really impact on us, I don't think. And my dad just couldn't stand to see us cry, so... And I thought it was funny now that I was of age. I didn't even have to get his permission, but it would never occur to me to go against what he thought. So they were just, people in the military were not, they didn't have a good reputation. I don't know any more details. It just, like that.
Just staring.
That's interesting. What reaction did your mother have? Did she?
She just didn't say too much. I don't recall what she said, so it must not have had any. oftentimes I thought back when something came up they couldn't handle, couldn't manage, they just tended to ignore it, not said anything. So after I was in, then they, I understand they were very proud, and that's all, you know, because my one little sister took issue with me. She didn't like me because that's all my mom talked about. But later on, we became good friends, too, so.
So when you decided to join the Navy, was your brother, was he still alive at that point?
Yes, he's 5 years younger, so he was like a little early pre-adolescent. So 12, 13. I came home on leave. He was always a real clean-cut kid and with a crew cut and everything. I brought my roommate home. He was 18. And he was going through a phase that he let his hair grow out, and he had this hair wool on it, all slicked back, you know, and I offered him $10 to go get a haircut, and he wouldn't do it. So.
Your brother?
Right. It was just a phase he was going through. So later on, he got it cut again. So if I knew now, then what I know now, I would probably talk to him into going to Canada, but we were not that kind of people. We didn't run away. And he always supported the military and told my mom that anybody that didn't have anything going for them, they would certainly benefit from being in the military. Any red-blooded American could afford 2 years to support, you know, for their country. And I don't think he would have lived with the kind of people that did everything they could to not go. And I know a lot of people have had trouble to this day from that, those kind of actions.
Well, let's go back to your story. When you, after your parents finally decided it was okay if you joined the Navy, what happened then? Where's your story pick up?
Well, I went to Louisville to sign up, and my blood pressure was so high, I'd go back out in the waiting room and calm down so I'd check it, you know, so it calmed down because I was so excited. And I don't have a nursing degree. I have a diploma. And so they said, you're the last person on earth that's going to get in with just a diploma. And then I did very well. To go into nursing school, I was the epitome of the quiet, shy, little backward girl. And the chief of that school didn't think I'd ever make it. So I fooled her because they gave awards and I won one of them. So you just can't always tell.
She didn't think you would make it through nursing school?
Because I was just so quiet and meek and quiet and everything. So in those days, you went to Rhode Island for 8 weeks, I think, of basic training. They taught you how to wear the uniform, and we had a course on weapons to tell the difference between a ship, an aircraft, and a shotgun, I guess. But it was all kind of laughable. And the funny thing is, I don't swim. I never did learn to swim, so I could float around in salt water, but I never did really learn to swim. So, but I joined up, and we went there. And to get on an airplane and fly away in those days, I don't know how I ever did it, but it was the best thing ever happened to me because I made some great new friends. You know, I'm a completely different person today than I would have stayed in Harlan County all those years. And I think the worst thing in the world is ignorance. You can't help being ignorant, but maybe you can work on learning something, you know. There's still a lot of ignorance in Harlan County and all of Kentucky. I think we pride ourselves on being a redneck state. The good old boys always win out, you know, you can edit all this. The thing about not having to wear a helmet for a motorcycle, and you know what I'm talking about. Anyway,
yeah.
So I made some great friends, and my first duty station was Jacksonville, Florida, Naval Air Station. And this was like January 64, because I was at the Rhode Island when Kennedy was shot. That was Thanksgiving that year. It was a terrible, terrible time. And it was winter time. We finished just before Christmas. So then I went to Florida, early 64. And I must have stayed there That was even, they broke ground for the new hospital while I was there. That was an old World War II building with the ramp. You did a lot of running of the ramps.
Where's that?
In the Naval Air Station in Jacksonville.
Okay.
And then close by was the jet station, I forgot what you call that. And then not too far away was the Mayport, was for the ship. So you had the whole thing of the Navy. In 65, I was there with my roommate, my best friend, when Vietnam heated up. And every young nurse in the whole military apparently would volunteer to go to Vietnam. We were really gung-ho, wanted to do our part. As it turned out, there wasn't room for all of them, so a whole bunch was sent to the Navy, the ships, hospital ships. Closest I got was Guam. And I went there in May of 66, I'm pretty sure it was. So I was in Florida for about 2.5 years. I stayed there 17 months, and that was an experience that I'm really glad I had, but I was really happy when it was over. It's we took care of all the military, plus some civilians, merchant seamen, some people, Japanese and Filipino, people didn't speak English, so it was about, the island is 7 miles long, 7 miles wide, maybe 30, I forgot how long, but there were 7 eating places. You could go out and eat at a different place one day a week, and you had to start over.
Like native restaurants or military?
Right, civilian institutions. So, and the patients, it was, we had a lot of wounded patients who were sent there to recuperate and had to go back. And during the season, we had wards that were strictly all malaria patients. So, and then we took care of the Air Force, which had the, you know, Anderson Air Force Base is there. So it was just a very difficult time. Once a week in our nurses' quarters, we had a little bar, and we would have happy hour. And we would have guys from the whole island, you know, that was still strictly officer and enlisted were separate, but all the officers, so we'd get lots of really nice little married people who were going to be on the straight and narrow by the end of the evening. You know, we had them swinging from the chandelier, so. And it didn't matter what you looked like. If you were female, you had a host of men friends, so everybody was going looking for a meaningful relationship. So nothing is perfect, I'm here to tell you. So it was a difficult time.
So did the officers come to your weekly bar?
They did,
night as
you
well?
Know, patients and Air Force, Navy, anybody that was around, that was the social scene of the island. And for the Navy, Navy nurses, to be asked to the Marine Corps Ball was a big event. So I went that year with a patient, and I went twice, once with him, and he had a little bit to drink, so the whole evening was fine. I don't remember any details about it, but I walked him back because he was a patient, and he had to walk me back because he's a Marine. We spent a whole lot of time doing that. I remember that was funny looking back on it. So it was a lot of amusing times.
What was he a patient for? Do you remember?
He'd been wounded some way. And, you know, I have the greatest respect for the Marine Corps. Some of my best friends are Marines, and I can call them jarheads and all these things, but it was quite a time. There was one little guy, I remember, he'd been shot and had to have a colostomy. And so it was all put back. So the whole hospital was, did Parker move the bowels yet? You know.
How did Parker feel about that?
I still think about
that.
Parker. Well, he was just happy when the event happened, so he didn't know that the whole staff was all concerned about him. So. And I traveled quite a bit. For me, I was able to go to Japan twice on leave, and my friend and I went through that saw the Philippines and saw a little bit of Okinawa and that whole route, I knew I would never have a chance to see that far east and travel that way. So I have since been able to go to Europe, but wouldn't have happened if I hadn't done that at that time.
Something sticks in my head, and this is just kind of a detail that I'm curious about. How did you all get the alcohol for the bar?
I don't remember, but it wasn't difficult. We always hired this one Filipino person to bartend, and then one of us, we took turns about assisting him, so it was not a problem. Apparently it was lawful. So
were most of the women that you spent time with in Guam, were they mainly nurses as well, or medical staff?
Right, mostly nurses. You didn't see that many female doctors in those days. I remember my one friend, she was vain, and she wore glasses, and so she would take glasses off at the door, and then she'd be like, who's here? Who's here?
Went around the room.
Who's here? Tell me where everybody is. What's going on?
Huh. Well, that leaves a lot of interesting things to asking if someone's attractive or not. You can tell her whatever you want, I guess.
Right. Well, she would someday put her glasses back on, you know, so. It was a time.
So how long did you spend there?
I was there for 17 months. I came home Christmas of 67. My next duty station was Camp Lejeune, North Carolina, because I had a meaningful relationship with this Marine, and he was going to be there, and then the meaningful relationship fell apart. So I was in Camp Lejeune. It's beautiful in the spring, which starts about February. And again, it was more of the same. By that time, the drug culture, I think that was one of the Viet Cong's tactics, was to get the drugs. Because all this time, I never ever felt afraid at night or anything. You know, you'd run the ramps again all by yourself in the middle of the night. And from 68 and 69, there started being incidents connected with drugs at the hospital. So I never felt threatened, but some people did. So I had orders to go to the desert in California. I can't think what you call it. It was a little air station. But I became pregnant, and so you couldn't be in the military and have a dependent. And that's another thing we don't do in the mountains, is give our children away. So I was going to be her mama, and you could stay in, or you could have your baby at there. I was unwed, and it wasn't cool in those days. So I had such a good chief nurse, she hired me back as a civilian while I waited for my baby to be born. So
in North Carolina?
Right. I was 8 months pregnant when my brother was died. So I had to come home. And there was over in the, they didn't have a new hospital either. They broke ground for a new hospital while because it was old ramps. And
what does running the ramps mean?
The hospital was built like a big run, sidewalk, and then the wards would be off like that. You'd have A, 2, 3, 4. So one nurse might have 4, 5, 6 of those wards.
So you'd have
so
one.
You ran the ramp to a different one.
One long sidewalk, and then it would tee off at the ramp to go up into the wards. You'd have some of the tees.
Okay. And the emergency room. But over here, away from everybody else, would be a little unit where you had women, you know, OBGYN, the nursery and all that. So that's where she put me to work while I was waiting for my baby to come. Because they would check on me, make sure my feet weren't swelling, you know, just watching out for my welfare. And she said, if you want to come back in the Navy, you can. But I knew I would have to give this child up to somebody. 7 years later, I found out when we had the exhibit over there is when they instituted they don't care what your circumstances are, apparently, and they have a maternity uniforms and all kinds of things. So I told my daughter, you missed being a Navy brat by 7 years. So So, as it was, once I came out, I made connections with the VA, and I had 6 years of active duty, so that counted on my time, so I became a VA nurse. I worked in Cincinnati for probably 2 years, and then I never did feel at home there. In 73, I came to Lexington because they were building this big new hospital, and came to work there and stayed until 96. I had worked 34 years, and I retired in 96 at age 55, because every year it was do more with less. And as you get older, it gets to be harder to do. So anyway, back to my brother. He was a natural born leader, and after he was lost, my mom just got all these accolades for him. People who wrote and told how he'd advised them on life choices and made sure they got on the right direction. He was just apparently wise beyond his years. There was some lady who was on the internet, and my sister's on the net, and somehow they made a connection, and she told how he had helped her in college, and if he hadn't helped her with a certain test, she wouldn't have graduated and become a teacher. And then there was a office on Vietnam vets in Washington some way, and they made a connection to me some year, and someone who had been with him when he was killed wanted to know about his family. So they called someone in Everts, and the police chief, as a matter of fact, and he talked to some relative I had there who let me know. And it boils down to this fella is in Washington, close to Seattle, Washington, and he'd never gotten over his service there, or losing my brother, because most of the kids in those days fighting the war were 17, 18, 19. So he was a wise old man at age 23. And he was sergeant. He made staff sergeant after he died. But this fella wanted to know about us and how things were. So we met in California because my daughter lived there at the time. And so he had a relative close to Los Angeles, and we made a connection, and we met and talked. And I guess he'd been having a hard time all these years. He said they were out in the boonies, and one guy in front triggered a booby trap, which is what killed my brother, the head wounds. And so he didn't die right away, but they had to carry him back somewhere to get on the helicopter, the loading zone, and they usually took turns about with that, and he wouldn't give up his spot, you know. So he'd been suffering, and I said, if my brother was here right now, he'd tell you, get up off your ass and get on with living and quit mooning and carry on. That's what I told him, so I don't hear from him anymore. I hope that he's doing well. So.
How much time had passed that he'd been feeling that kind of guilt?
That was 70. This was between 96 and 97, so almost 20 years.
Long time. Is that the first time you'd heard someone talk about how your brother actually died?
How he died?
Is that the first time you'd heard about the details of how he died?
I hadn't heard that many details. Soon after it happened, there was a boy that came back, and he made contact with my sister in Cincinnati, and he wanted to come visit. My dad could not. He was alive until 89. He couldn't stand to hear all the details. My mom, I could see how people divorced over things like this, because she liked to sit and talk about it from now on and cry. But he couldn't stand to talk about it, so we didn't let that boy come. We said, no, you know, he doesn't want to see you. I'm sorry. But he did come to my sister's house. I guess I found out later they visited and everything. The Army just said it was a booby trap. And then I had to go with my dad to visit, see the body, to make sure. My dad had to go see. My mom never did look at him. So So Daddy had to make sure it was him, and it was. You could see that the damage. And so I didn't probe any. But at some point in time, maybe 10 years later, I had a call. I live in Lexington. And I'm under, in the phone book as M.A. Davis. So I got a call, and this boy had known him in a fraternity at Moorhead. And he really enjoyed the, he enjoyed life. He had, you know, took a big bite of everything. He enjoyed the fraternity, the whole college scene. So this guy had not heard about him for a long time, and he just thought it'd be a great thing to look him up. So he started, and he must have called it. I don't know how he did it, but because I was him, he thought I could have been. So he wanted to know where he was, and I had to tell him what had happened to him. And he was just crushed. He said, I should have stayed in touch. I should have. But that was painful. There was a boy from Harlan County. You may know about sports. He was the NCAA that helped make it such a big thing. Kay Wood somebody. He just died recently.
Was it, wasn't Kay Wood Ledford, was it?
No, it wasn't. It's the one that was his second or third cousin.
Okay.
And they were about the same age. And Martin, I don't know if he knew him. I don't know how he knew him, but if he knew him, we're in. But he's one that got him, he advised him to get him going in that direction. And he had a great career as a as administrator of the NCAA. I can't, his name had Kay Wood in it. I should have all these facts written down, but.
Those are easy enough to find out with that kind of detail.
Well, you mentioned earlier that you were 8 months pregnant and in North Carolina whenever you got word. What happened?
That was, as a matter of fact, I got out of the Navy November the 7th of 69. And I didn't tell any of my family except my mom and dad. And so she said, you need to call your brother. So he was out in the field, wherever he was, still in training. And I called, and they went out in the field and got him. They said, your wife's on the phone. It's an emergency. He said, if that's my wife, it is an emergency. So I told him, and he wanted to know if he should come up there and beat up somebody or something. I said, no, that won't be necessary. You know, it's all right. So I'm 5 years older, and that's the thing he did. He had a rough role. He had four sisters, and he tried to be a big brother and a protector of all the time. Cause I remember once I had a date, and I didn't have that many because my folks were so. We were just down the road at a little cafe, and he's outside, you know, checking them out and being mean and all that kind of stuff, making sure I was
staring him down.
That was funny. So, when he left, just before Christmas in 69, and he left money to buy her a crib and all that. You know, he knew she was coming. Because, I don't know. My mom could tell you a whole lot more. He had a car that he was going to, he wanted to buy, so it was a great waste of a great human being. And you hear that, you know, most of the kids that were there, I think that when the shooting starts, they just take anybody in, they have cannon fodder. But he wasn't just anybody, he was a very special person.
I have to ask you a question. Going back a little bit, you mentioned the sibling rivalry when you were younger, and it occurs to me that that you were Navy, and that when he drafted, he was Army, and I was wondering if that ribbing ever happened.
No, that
there.
Never did. By that time, we were good friends, and because when I first came home, he was like an older teenager, a lot. And Vietnam had been going on so long, and my mom was already worried about him. I said, Mom, it can't last that long. You know, I reassured her, something's got to give, but it did, and it did, and it did. Because anybody who'd been in the military he was always wanting, trying to get me to put my uniform on and go where they were, make them salute me. It was a lot of silly stuff. And anybody who'd been in, they were wanting to spit shine my shoes to show off that they knew how to do it, all kinds of silly stuff. So there was one little guy that was a friend. He was younger than me. He was their friend in high school. And I think he ended up having 3 tours in Vietnam. I volunteered. And then I guess later you had to have a psych evaluation to do more than one. But he needed one because he did have mental problems. And he's just a little basket case today. It was just a very sad thing.
What if your parents, specifically your mom, was really worried that your brother was going to get drafted? How did they feel when you enlisted to go off to Vietnam?
Well, I understand that she was kind of worried while I was there, like I'd be bombed or something. And I said, "No, we're way far away from the fighting, and the bombs will be dropping." So she's always been the one to see the worst. The glass is always half empty and all that. And him being her last surviving son, she just expected the worst, and it came to pass. I think I spent most of my growing up years chasing around trying to protect him, because he just was hell-bent, you know, full speed ahead, always in danger of getting hurt. And when my dad, after the mines quit, this whole time was just boom and bust. It was a bad time in the economy in the mountains. And we were taught, I don't know how, by osmosis, I guess, you don't expect somebody else to give you stuff. We weren't. When I went away and came back in 70, I worked at the hospital there for 3 months before I went to the VA. I was shocked. Everybody had a hospital card, and they were going to the school, and then just before they graduate, they changed and go to a different school so you could get a pension or a give me that. And that's the way it is today. I guess it was the beginning of the end of the mountains. Now we're into the pill culture. It's okay to be nervous and get pain pills and nerve pills from your doctor, but it's not okay to see a psychiatrist, because that means you're crazy. So it's all very sad. But anyway, I lost my train of thought.
We were talking about how your parents felt whenever you went overseas.
So she was a little bit concerned, but my sister was mad at me because she bragged about me all the time. So I guess they were proud. But I told Bill earlier, when I first went to Rhode Island, it's Newport, to the school, I had all these people say, "How did you get here? You know, we had to come to the mountains and chase the men down and capture them, so what are you?" And I got all kinds of stuff like, "Did you paint your feet white?" Or, "Let me see if one leg's shorter than the other from walking on the mountains all this time." All kinds of old stereotypes and everything, but it was said in good fun, or else, you know. I don't think anybody was really making fun of me, but the stereotypes were there, so.
Where were other people from that were your classmates?
My best friend was from Glens Falls, New York, and another girl was from Long Island. She was 6 foot tall, and she was Italian extraction, but she was a lieutenant already because she had a master's degree. But she had no sense of direction, so we were like Mutt and Jeff. You know, I'm an ensign from Harlan County, and I'd lead her around, show her where to go and everything, so that was a lot of fun. And they were from all over, actually. Just those two stand out. They were probably my best friends.
When you came back home to Harlan County after your brother died, did you stay there?
No. He was killed on April the 4th, 1970, so I came home. I was working as a civilian at the same hospital where she's going to be born. And I came home for the funeral, and my parents were just lost. They were just devastated. And so they went back with me to North Carolina to wait for her to be delivered. And luckily she came almost a week early, so she was born April 27, which is birthday's Monday. And when she was 10 days old, then I moved. We all came back to Harlan County. Somebody who worked in a bakery in Cincinnati heard about my dad being out of work again, and this man knew him and his work ethic. So he's up in his 50s by this time, but this man sends for him to come up there and work for him in this bakery. So he wanted to work there and come home on weekends, but we would have none. My mom said absolutely not, because that's a pretty far drive, and even in those days it was, and the weather being bad. So we prepared to move to Cincinnati. So I called the VA and they were happy to get me, and so I worked at that hospital there in Harlan for 3 months. Somebody was off having a baby, so I just filled in for her. And I got a really great recommendation from that chief nurse to the one in Cincinnati, because she showed it to me, because it was so good. So I was blessed all these years to have great champions. And we stayed in the house with my mom and dad. They wanted to babysit until Becky was 18 months old. My mom was in the, this won't be online, I know, but she was in the worst depression for, after a year's time, I'm thinking to myself, how can I help these two people? You know, how are we going to go on? We had to, I understand my other sister said, you've got other children. You know, you've got other children. So they kind of snapped at it, but they were never the same. You know, the light went out. And this baby, after 8 months, she was too big. Big, healthy, bouncing baby. You know how to get, for her to handle. So I had to get a babysitter. And soon after that, I thought we'd do better in our own place. So I got an apartment. And then she was almost three. 18 months later, we moved to Lexington. So,
are your parents still in Cincinnati then?
No, as soon as he retired, and by the end of that summer, he was old enough. He had the black lung from the coal mines. So he was able to retire, and they moved back to Everett. So he said, my dad said, the world didn't start until you were in Pineville. That's when you have to look up to see the sky. So that's one of those pictures, you know, you see the mountains in the background. He felt very comfortable coming to my house in Lexington. I would work an off tour, an evening shift or a night shift, and they would come and stay for a month at a time. He felt very much at home at my house, so she would take over the kitchen, he would take over the yard. It was a great deal for me. So, and he was very close to my daughter. He always drove her to school, which she could walk it in 10 minutes, but that was his job. And he told me when she was 13, all she had to do was look pretty and go to school. I didn't agree with that.
I was about to say, what did you have to say about that?
I had a few things to say, because like all parents, I guess, want to make sure I didn't repeat what they had done wrong with me, you know. So she had other things to do besides look pretty and go to school.
That's good.
But she's turned out wonderfully well, so.
Do you think that it helped your parents a little with the mourning process that they had a new grandbaby shortly after?
I think it helped to engage them, but, and there are people who might say, you know, Lord give us and takes away. I don't know why things work out the way they did. But I was going to say, my family, my dad had a half-brother named Jack Martin, and he was in World War II. He was just a teenager when his mother died, so he ends up going to the Army, and pretty soon the war is over. So he comes home and has a bad marriage, and he goes back in and is just in Korea at the right time to be captured. He was one of the Tiger POWs. So he survived. and he's had a great life. He didn't get connected to the VA and his POW status until really late in life. He worked in the steel mills in Gary, Indiana. He's still alive.
He's still alive.
Uh-huh. And then my mother had two brothers, and one of them was drafted out of the high school just at the end of World War II. And they tell me he was on the ship headed for Japan when the war ended. And it was so awful there at that time that he enlisted for longer so he could leave, and he went to Germany and spent a year or two in Germany, which was apparently better by that time. So then he came out of the military and was called back up for Korea. And I think he was in the Air Force at that time, but he didn't have to leave the States. And then he was home, and he planned to take his family. By this time he'd married and had two children. And the youngest was about 3 or 4 weeks old when he was killed in the mines. He was just getting enough money ahead to move out away from the mountains. And so that's one of the losses she's had. You know, when you get to be 86, you have a lot of losses. So. And then her baby brother, he just died a couple years ago, her baby brother. He was 75, but he was in the military, but during peacetime.
Well, it seems like there's a little bit of family tradition of the military. You expressed earlier about, you know, the military's not necessarily looked upon as a favorable opportunity.
In the broad culture, but I don't know why we were different, but we didn't, like when I had my baby, you know, we didn't ask anybody or tell anybody. It was not any of their business. Mm-hmm. So now it's the cool, everybody's doing it, you know. So... We didn't always go along with what everybody, we didn't worry that much about what other people thought.
So do you think that that family tradition kind of gave you the courage to say, I want to be in the Navy?
I think it just seemed like the most wonderful thing to do, to get away and see something new and different. I think my granddaughter's going to be like that. My daughter says, she's just like you, Mom.
How old is your granddaughter now?
The oldest is going to be 6 in September, and she's very inquisitive, and she just is the most fun little girl you ever could imagine. I told him I took one of those Abraham Lincoln hats. I was here that day. I wanted her to be here, but they couldn't make it. The hat and the little beard that they had in the store. Mm-hmm. So I gave it to her, and she looked at it. I gave one to my niece's child, and she just looked at me like, what ever possessed you to buy me this? But my niece looked at my granddaughter looked at it, and then she tried it on, and then in a few minutes she pulled a rabbit out of it. So she uses every opportunity. She has a great imagination. There's a picture of me in uniform at some point. My daughter saw it. She's about 3, and she said, Mommy, I didn't like you as a policeman. But Anna Katie, my granddaughter, she has seen it, and she likes it a lot. So I want to bring her here to this place and show her off, let her see it. I said, it's my museum, you know. I worked here from probably about 15 months, once a week, as a volunteer, get everything ready, and then we helped move into it, because you had people on this end and people on that end, people riding the truck. Make sure nothing got
lost. When was that?
April of what?
I guess that would have been 98.
April of 98. So I worked 97 to 98.
Yeah. So you're helping move from the old State Capitol Annex to the new building here?
They had different units, so we did different projects. One of them was cleaning the silver, and I show that off all the time. You know, my IT staff. But it just segued into great thing, and he would have really been interested because history was his thing.
Your brother.
Mm-hmm.
Well, let's talk about that a little bit. You and your mother donated some of your brother's military, items. Why?
You called to say you were going to have this exhibit of female uniforms. Did I have anything? Well, it just so happens I had a box full sitting out in the garage, which had been there for 15 years. And I didn't know what shape they were in, but I pulled them out and put them to the dry cleaners, and he said later, "You have the most interesting cleaning I've ever had." One of them was a dress uniform that you wore, and it even had a little silly tiara on top if you went to a full ball in the evening, you know. So you, I think my cousin said he didn't even know such one existed. So I was happy to put them in a place where they'd be safe and get them out of the garage before the bugs got them. Because I did that, my mom thought, well, she had my brother's full, it wasn't a dress uniform, what do you call it?
Well, I think the greens were in there, and then there was a duffel bag and a variety of pieces.
Okay, so she was happy to know they're in a place where they'd be appreciated and would last for a long time. So she donated those also. That's when I saw the first maternity uniform, and that was a fun day because I was coming from Lexington, and I had a family contingent coming from Shelbyville, which is where my mother moved to after my dad died. After she lived with me 4 years, then she decided she needed her own place. So I was late because traffic held me up. So I saw this big crowd, and then I came on down the hill and parked and walked back up. They had saved me a parking place up there. So I said, my only time in my life I ever had a parking place special, and I missed it, you know. So, and then I saw other women in there who had donated uniforms, and one lady said, "Can you still fit in yours?" And I said, "I think at that time I was just one size bigger, so I could have squeezed in, but it would have been uncomfortable." But she said, "Yes, she could. Her leg would go in it." So it was fun.
Had you already been volunteering here by that time, or was that before you volunteered?
I think I had been volunteering. That's how they knew to ask me.
Right. I think through the volunteer process, we were able to speak and found out that we wanted to represent the story as we could. And I think one of the interesting pieces was you and your mother came down to bring your brother's items, and the duffel bag that was there, I don't think had been opened at that point. So
I'm not sure. I don't even remember the duffel bag. Yeah. But she got a whole lot of his stuff from Vietnam, and I went through some of it looking for pictures, and mm-hmm. It brings back a lot.
I just remember the afternoon opening it, and your mother was telling me it was the first time she had seen the contents of that bag, and we'd pulled out the various pieces, and it was a tough and emotional moment. I mean, it was really, really something that hit home, and it's stuck with me all these years.
I'm a lot like my dad, though, emotionally, that I can't sit and cry with her. Some of my sisters can, but I have to get up and go. So you feel it, you just don't, you can't share it with people as much.
Well, I think that I find that interesting that that I guess the military sent home all his personal effects, and
well, this one green uniform that was, it stayed. It didn't go to Vietnam with him. So some of it was stuff that he'd left with her. And I guess you have different gear when you're going out about the war. And I don't know. I know the green uniform he didn't take with him. It was like going to the Marine Corps ball with those Marines who were patients in the hospital. They didn't have to have the big dress uniform that the Marines who were stationed on the island did. They just had little khakis, you know, they were whatever they could get scared of.
That's all. It's interesting how objects can tell such meaningful stories just in themselves.
If you know the history, the background. I've got one of his field jackets, I guess. Mm-hmm. It's just a little khaki thing. And I wore it one day to work, so I could show this guy. And he could almost tell me what year it was. You know, they change. Mm-hmm. As a nurse in the Navy, I know the time I was in, we still had to have starched cotton uniforms. You took them to the cleaners, and they came back, they would stand alone almost. And you put all the hardware in it. just about the time I was getting out, 69, they were going to the process, rayon or some sort of like that. I know they had to be at least mid-calf, so if you bent over, they didn't go above your, show your knee in the back.
And your skirt.
Your skirt of your uniforms, any of your uniforms, right. They had all the, they had reasons for everything. And you wore a girdle. Anytime you were in uniform, nothing could jiggle. And if you were in on parade or, you know, been inspected, it was women officers, but they'd give you a flick. They'd tell if you had your girdle on or not. So you'd be in bad trouble if you didn't have your girdle on.
Was it a government-issued girdle?
I don't think so. But it took, after 6 years, it took a long time to quit wearing one. I mean, you know, you feel like you left something out, or honestly, it took some adjustment.
Well, no wonder they didn't have maternity uniforms.
They probably didn't even have maternity girdles at the time.
Yeah.
To get into, I think, nursing pantsuits just came into vogue about 1970. And somebody got me one for Christmas. The idea was just ridiculous. And somebody bought me one, and I wore it. I thought, oh, this is great. So I hardly have a dress anymore, so.
I'm still thinking about having to wear a girdle in the military. I'm sorry. It's just so foreign to anything I can think about.
It was, you know, skinny little girls that didn't need one. It was part of the uniform.
So, I have another question, too, that I've been thinking about since you talked about being sent over to Guam. When you found out that you were, that's where you were going, how did you feel about that? Did you know anything about where you were going?
I didn't really, but I guess they gave you facts. My roommate, my best friend, she went to Guam also, and she went like 3 or 4 months before me, so... In those times, you worked certain areas of the hospital, and then for 2 weeks straight, like 14 days in a row, you'd do your off tour, either nights or nighttime. And I'd had some OB experience, because after I graduated, I worked at Hazard for a year on OB. Mm-hmm. To show how dumb I was, we were supposed to rotate with 3 or 4 nurses, but I look back, and in the year's time, I worked 9 months of night shift, so. I think I was pretty dumb. People are always taking advantage, especially if you're short and you talk like me. And so I did my off tours on either pediatrics or OB. And I can't remember what Renee did. I think she was in ICU. I hadn't worked ICU during those times. I did later on at the VA. But I remember she got, probably we were all severely depressed periodically, because she got mono, and that depressed her terribly. And we were sweet mates there. You had a room and shared the bathroom. At one point, my room got so bad that somebody made a comment they were going to get me a shovel. Looking back, I think that was depression. So,
what do you think was the stem of that?
Just the environment. You know, you had people with terrible, terrible wounds, and the Marines, they would have to, they had to be completely rehabilitated and ready to go back to the war, and they'd have one day a week where they'd have a call, have to stop, be on hand to see the doctor. And when he had to tell them, it was just like giving them a death sentence sometimes. It was very, very strenuous. Some of the wounds were terrible, and we had some Native patients, because I remember one time you'd have 30, 40 patients in this one big long room, and the sicker ones were closer to the middle of where the nurse's station was. 2 or 3 rooms off in the back were either for officers or the worst, sickest patients. And this one day, this Islander. He was, I'm not sure how come he was there, but he'd had stomach surgery because he had the ulcers or something. So I looked at his NG tube coming out, and there was food coming out, mashed potatoes and green beans and whatever. Somebody had fed him his lunch with his tube. You know, just back from surgery, they'd given him his lunch. So it was quite a time. But the human side, there was at the hospital in Florida before I went to Guam. I told you that they were a lot of cannon fodder. In those days, at the beginning, they said Navy corpsmen were the second smartest kids that came in. First went to electronics, and second was corpsmen. But after the shooting started, and they'd go with the Marines and get wiped out all the time, you started getting a lot more dumb kids, because one time there was one that was, I would run the ramp in the evening, and you'd have to check all the sick people and the ones that had surgery that day and make sure everybody got their food. And this kid was in the back room for some reason as a patient. The corpsman didn't know he's back there, so he ate his lunch. Well, he was so stupid that they said once they got to Vietnam, the Marines would check him out and see if they thought they had what it took. If not, they didn't last long. That really happened. And that's when the drug scene was getting more obvious, and they started fragging their officers that they couldn't handle it and all that kind of, you know, a lot of really bad stuff. So there were corpsmen that I remember with great pride and affection. This one old black kid, and he was a senior corpsman on the ward, and he was great and very dependable and did a wonderful job. One day I came to work, and there was a little coconut, a little black coconut, and it had a little nurse's cap on and a little face. It was me, so that was fun. You know, I still have that coconut somewhere.
That seems to me just a question I had. You mentioned this and hadn't elaborated on it, but during your time on Guam, you're essentially helping Marines, you know, convalesce with the intent to go back from where they had come, and obviously the 65, 66 Vietnam keeps heating up.
Right.
So your feelings on that kind of position, I don't know if you would like to share those or.
I'm not sure now. Which kind of position?
Well, just what it
the Marines
seemed like dealing with these human beings that then
having to nurse people back to health to know that they're going back
well,
somewhere.
Well, they would have air evacs. They bring in a group of people in the night on airplanes, and you walk on the unit, and you could have been Miss America. You know, you were that. They hadn't seen a American girl in so long. It didn't matter what you looked like; you were wonderful. And some little guy offered. He showed me a picture of his child and offered to give me one just like it. You know, they had all different kind of approaches, but they just had. You see things from this one guy's psychological problems, but his trigger finger didn't work right. So they airbagged him to Guam. I don't know what happened to him, but from that, every degree of patient, really terrible, terrible wounds. Helicopter pilots would get shot in the rear end from, you'd be flying out when they get them. And so they would use these great big wire sutures and put their big butt muscles back together, and they couldn't sit down for a long time. So that's how you would know, because you'd see them standing up to eat and everything. But some of my best friends were like that. And if they were shot in the wounded in the arm, in the legs, they'd still be in bed, you know, working, exercising, and thinking their body. And you'd have this big long ward with multiple beds, the sickest ones closest to you. Then there would be a sunroom just outside a solarium, and they put bunk beds in there for the ones who were recuperating. And you'd have to be careful not to put a leg wound up on the second top bunk, because they'd have trouble climbing, and just all kinds of things like that. Then you see the ones who were stoic, and they would just be there when they're supposed to and take their medicine and get ready and go back. And I remember one old guy, he was an officer, and I guess he could have had a choice to either go back or go home. and his wife and his mother were on the phone all the time trying to talk him into coming on home, and he wasn't. He was going back. That stuck in my mind. And there were a few you'd have to chase down because they were absent, actually not there when the doctor's looking for them. Then they'd have another whole week. So they're just the greatest. It's like at the VA, I know the World War II men. I said they are the greatest generation because if that's what I saw, they were just great people. What they would have been like as young men, you know. So, you know, the Vietnam, I saw the ones who went, didn't have any qualms about going. I didn't see the other. I saw some of them as doctors, and they hated what they were doing, and it showed. You know, one doctor at the VA was having a fit, and I said, "What's your problem? Why are you doing here?" "Well, stay out of Vietnam." I mean, he just told me outright. So, my respect for him just. Right on down the tube. Well, he said that day he was having a fit. He said, "I'd rather be pumping gas." So I said, "Well, why are you here? What's your problem?" Vietnam. He was honest.
And that was after your brother.
That was in the 70s, right?
Right.
I have a question. Just listening to all of this and trying to put this together. It seems like it was kind of a challenge for you to go home and tell your parents that you decided to sign up with the military when you did, was it?
Yeah, because I hadn't done it yet. You know, I felt like I'd have their permission.
Yeah.
So I said, I would really like to. And I laughed and said, I don't know where the idea came from. Then I thought back, well, she came once a month. That's she was doing it. She worked hard.
Do you think it was more challenging to go home and tell them you decided to sign up for the Navy, or to tell them that you were going to have a baby?
Probably to say I was pregnant, but that was very hard. I called her on the phone and I said, I need to talk to you. Is anybody there? Well, somebody was visiting, so she said, come back in a little while. And she was very supportive. My whole family was always very supportive. Once they found out, I guess, just a short time before he was killed, they found out, and they were just all just a gaga. Why didn't you tell us, you know, what's wrong with you? And one said, I would make you something, but I don't have much time left. So they had two grandchildren. My sister had two children by then, so they didn't have that many grandchildren. And I had this crazy notion that my dad wouldn't like her unless she looked just like us. So I thought, gosh, I hope she looked like me. She did not look like me at all. She looked like her father, but my dad loved her. They were just very close, very special relationship. So that was funny going home after he was killed, because my sister came to North Carolina to get me. She and her husband came down and told me in person. They didn't call and say because of my condition. So they drove back, and my dad always had the greatest faith in me that I would take care of things. Somebody said, what if she goes into labor? He said, well, she'll just deliver it and come on home. You know, he wasn't worried. And I had a granny, my mother's mother, who was a little busybody lady. And we didn't have much to do with her. We had already broken off that branch, as mountain people have a habit of doing. We had a big disagreement. So she came over to our house, and my brother-in-law, or my dad, one, stayed right by my shoulder the whole time so she couldn't ask me any personal questions or get any digs in or anything. Must have been very disturbing for her, but they were all very protective, and I never had a bad word from any of them.
That's great.
It seems to be a family thing, and those mountain families are close.
Yeah, my dad had never really been out of Kentucky, probably, and he was in North Carolina for about 3 or 4 weeks, and we saw the ocean, and he saw things, and once was enough, you know. Mm-hmm. We finally, later on in life, made him quit traveling. My sister lived in Michigan. We almost insist he go with us sometimes, but he was so unhappy about it. We just started one of us to stay home and with him, somebody else to take my mom. So He'd seen all he ever cared about seeing. He was a homebody.
I can see. I know people like that. It's just an amazing experience. You have so many different perspectives of a lot of things that were going on.
At the time I was in the military, you're so busy doing your job, you know there's fussing going on, you know, but you don't really get the impact of how people are protesting and carrying on. And nobody ever spit on me or gave me a hard time personally, but I guess a lot of kids coming home did have that, and that was really rotten. I was in Cincinnati, worked there for a couple of years, I guess. The race riots had already subsided and all that, but this one girl I worked with, she was white. She said she went home every day and said, "You are not white trash. You're not white trash," because a lot of the employees were black, and it's close to downtown. And some of them had a great attitude, but some of them still had a really bad attitude.
And would call it white trash?
No, it's not overt, but something you felt, you know, as just their attitude towards it was surly. I realized early on going to the VA that they seemed to be having trouble taking care of the patients they had. I didn't see how they could ever manage to take care of all the young ones, and I was right in that, you know, for years they tried to not own up to the Vietnam, the PTSD disorder and all that. I think that it's still ongoing. Today you've read in the paper about what's going on with the HIV and all that stuff. It's disgusting.
That's interesting. What years were you at the VA?
From September of 70 until June of 96.
So you saw a lot of shift
changes.
from within the VA.
Right.
Because, of course, the military changed significantly in the 70s. And 80s, and then again in the 90s.
Right. I was still in when Richard Nixon took office. And I said, I'm sure there wasn't a connection, but that day we didn't have any sheets to go on the bed at the Naval Hospital. It was in Florida. So something happened with the laundry. But I said, I'm kind of a devout Democrat. Just what you'd expect, you know, from, I said, Mr. Nixon takes office and there's no sheets for the bed. So what do you think about that? So
that's a great quote. I like that.
And then I was at the VA, like when Truman died, there were several presidents that died right there frequently. And there was no matter what happened politically in Washington, whoever was the president would use the VA employees as examples. If there wasn't going to be a raise this year, the VAs would be the ones that were not going to get a raise, or this, that, and the other. And there was some raise somewhere, and the president had to be sued to get it for us. And they did sue him and did get a little raise. So during the 80s, I guess it was, Reagan was going to drug test us all. And I feel adamant that if I have a drug problem, somebody's going to know about it from my behavior. And that's one thing, you're not going to drug test me. So I thought there has to be a limit, and that's going to be it. But they never did try. They talked a lot about it and came close. I guess looking back, I should have written a book. I should have kept a journal and put all this stuff down, but because you forget a lot. But patient-wise, a lot of it was difficult, but life is difficult. And I would do it all again. I would change some stuff. Not for me, but, you know, for my family.
You still get down to Harlan County?
My mom and I go every Memorial Day. Because I said, it helps me to go down there once in a while. Your heartstrings are connected down there. And she has her spot right there between the two of them. So it's a beautiful view. To go by our house, because she sold her house finally, and I knew every blade of grass in the house and in the yard and every inch of the house, so it was hard that we lived in when we were growing up. But I'm glad I lived down there. And my daughter's glad she didn't have to be raised down there. It's a great place to be from.
Any interest in your daughter from her to join the military at any point, or did she bypass that?
She didn't ever want to be a nurse. And later on in life, she did grow up and she met her father, and that didn't work out really well. So, but she insisted, and I think the only thing I really worried about was how she would take what I did as she grew up, and she. She likes me okay. Because she knows that a lot of people didn't keep their children and care for them. And
was her father military?
He was a Marine. And it was just the Vietnam thing. I don't care to go into that, but it was...
Well, I think it sounds like you've done a really good job with your life. Full life.
Well, I said I wouldn't change anything. So. Mm. I've had opportunities. If the VA, if the Miners Memorial Union hadn't had a hospital at that time, because we were apparently all bright kids and we should have had a counselor who we could all go to Berea College, but none of us went because the counselors, apparently we didn't have them in those days, or they weren't doing their jobs or something. My second little sister, the one under me, she went to Cincinnati, worked for Ma Bell, and rose up through management just on her intelligence alone and did great. The next one, she wanted to be a hairdresser, so they scraped up enough to let her go to school for that. It didn't take much in those days. She never did really work at it, but she was in Michigan, and her husband was a union leader, so... She was a steward, union steward at her hospital. She was a building management. And she retired. And then my youngest sister got her master's. She's worked in early childhood development. She just retired last year. So overall, we all did okay.
Mm-hmm. Is there anything else you want to ask about Bill?
I'm good.
Is there anything else that we missed that you want to talk about?
No, I feel like it was all very disjointed, and I'm sorry I rambled on, but I don't...
That's the way these go. That's the way we remember things and the way we think about things, and it all fits together somehow. It always does.
I just know that my dad, I don't know how he taught us, because we didn't sit around and talk about things. He didn't really talk about stuff unless he'd had a little nip. And he didn't do that on weekends. And then he would tell us stories from his youth and everything. But we must have got it by osmosis, that you pay your bills first, and then spend anything you have left over. And you don't steal, lie, cheat, all that rot. So I'm happy how we all turned out.
Yeah. Right. Thanks so much for coming in.
Well, you're very welcome. And you let me know when it goes online and how we access it and all that. So
we'll send you a copy of this, too. We'll send you one on CD.
I don't know if I let my relatives hear all of it. So
you can make that decision. Just don't tell them it's here.
I'll hide it somewhere.
There you go.